like to continue the reflection on being embodied in this first domain, in inhabiting the body, what actually gets in the way of that, and why the Buddha gives it such significance in terms of being such a transforming and fertile ground of insight, and in many ways the body being a kind of microcosmic view of the rest of our lives and the ways that we dissociate or create dissonance in the rest of our lives. So what the Buddha was really pointing towards was not only the inhabiting of our body with mindfulness, but learning to inhabit the story of our body with insight, including the story of frailty and pain and illness that are written into each story. And what difference, you know, the question is, what difference would it make to actually live that story and truly live within the understanding of our own story of frailty and mortality and change? Because it's really said that this, it is inhabiting that story, that in this teaching, that is the roots of ethics. It's the roots of kindness. It's the roots of compassion and appreciation. So any of you who are familiar with the Satipatthana, and I know it's many of you, will come across this line that says, contemplate the body internally and contemplate the body externally. Now, of course, that instruction is really interpreted in a whole number of different ways, and I think it's one of those Dharma arguments and discussions that will go on for eternity. So I'm just going to short-circuit it. But when the way that I read this is that when we look at the story of our body, we actually see that story reflected in all bodies. That all of our actions, speech, and choice are manifested through our bodies. And when we look around us, we see that the story of our body is the story of all bodies. You look around you in this room, and you do not find one person who is exempt. Not one person who is exempt from mortality. Not one person who is exempt from change, from frailty, from illness. And in a way, if we deny or dissociate from the story of our bodies, we will tend to enact those same patterns of dissociation in relationship to the story of all bodies. Then we don't know how to care because we are anxious. We are fearful. We become overprotective. And in doing so, too easily close the doors to compassion, to empathy, to connectedness and kindness. When we think about, if I might say, call them the wholesome learnings or the skillful learnings of appreciating and embodying our mortality, I think it really means that everything matters. If this was our last day, how would we choose to live it? Our actions matter. Ethics make a difference. Every word and act of honesty and kindness and compassion makes a difference. And our speech certainly matters. It certainly matters. This area of our bodily body that is probably falls for most people within the greatest domain of impulsiveness. It certainly matters with its remarkable power to harm or to heal. And the present moment matters. I want to read you something I came across by a man called Philip Simmons. Some of you may be familiar with this, who was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease in 1993 and died 9 years later. He says, I stand at the edge of a life made shorter by illness, and can't help being pulled out of the present moment into mourning my losses, courting my fears. I sigh over my lost prowess as a hula dancer. I fear the day when I will be unable to lift a spoonful of lime jello to my lips. But we all stand at the edge. The present moment is itself an edge, this evanescent sliver of time between past and future. We're called away from it continuously by our earthly pleasures and concerns. Even now, you may be thinking it's time for another cup of coffee and one of those blueberry muffins. Seems it's always time to be doing something other than what we're doing at the moment. While reading in your chair, you find yourself thinking about last night's argument with your spouse. You're thinking it's time to rake the leaves, check your email, get some sleep. The present moment, like the spotted owl or the sea turtle, has become an endangered species. Yet more and more I find that dwelling in the present moment, in the face of everything that would call us out of it, is our highest spiritual discipline. More boldly, I would say that it is our very presentness is our salvation. The present moment entered into fully is our gateway to eternal life. I just want to temper this a little bit, well, not temper it, but just acknowledge, you know, the way that we need to understand what this phrase, present moment, actually means. You know, because I know it's one of those phrases like the word mindfulness that becomes so easily cliched, you know, and we think of it almost as being an end in itself, you know. Just be present, we tell ourselves, you know, or we tell others, or others tell us. You know, just be present. But what is actually, there's something much deeper than this, because, you know, I think that's easily interpreted as thinking, well, there is no place for past and future. But of course, that would be so unrealistic. And it's so important to acknowledge that past and future, of course, arise only in the present, as a thought, as a memory, as an idea. It's important to remember we speak about present moment recollection, the sense of collectedness, of integration, through establishing ourselves in this present moment experience. So it is so important not to turn this into a cliché. But I think I have a sense that it's only really when we embrace our mortality fully with compassion that do we embrace our life fully and stop abandoning out of fear of change, out of fear of loss. Now, I mentioned how much we learn about the lessons of mortality and frailty, that first level of dukkha within the body. We learn something about change, and we learn something about this second domain of dukkha, which is about the world not only of change, but the world of unpredictable and unstable conditions. Depending on the conditions of our life, things can change in a moment, can't they? Health can turn to illness. Strength turns to frailty. And studying the body carefully, we see that nothing stands still for us. This is an understanding for our lives, that we have the appearance of a solid body, that in a way camouflage the reality of change and the reality of the ways in which conditions are coming together in every moment. We know this intellectually, and yet to embody it is truly challenging. Someone close to me, after, you know, the near death of her husband, you know, she said to me, "It is terrifying to think that in a moment you could lose everything that you love." And it is. And I said, you know, "But it has always been this way. And much of human activity is dedicated to pretending it is not so. To pretending it is not so." The most phenomenal thing, and this is really, we can greet this with a lot of fear and a lot of trepidation, is actually seeing how very little we are in control of conditions. It's a simple truth, isn't it? We can't decide only to have pleasant experiences in the body, only to have stamina and youth. The body has a life of its own, constantly being influenced by conditions outside of us, our control. And that is so hard for us to accept. Isn't control our last mechanism of defense against impermanence? It's the one we know how to apply or try to apply. This is something I can do. You know, I can try to control it all. And think of how much energy in our life goes into trying to control the conditions of our life in small and big ways to protect us from the reality of change, the reality of mortality, the reality of loss. It's so hard for us to accept. It's hard for us to accept internally, and it's so hard for us to accept externally, particularly in those we love and care for, that we cannot take dukkha, or the pain of pain, away from. Now, this instability of conditions, again, is not a value judgment. There is nothing ethical about it. It is a simple reality. And we learn, you know, we learn in seeing that to question the idea of ownership of the body as me. If I was the body, or the body belonged to me, or who I am, believe me, I would be doing a lot better job than I'm actually doing. I would be able to control what's going on. You know, I would be able to capture those moments that I really cherish. But we can't. You know, it's said now that 30 is the average age when you look at in the mirror and see your mother or father beginning to look back at you. 57 is the average age for a person in this country to encounter their first chronic illness, the one that doesn't go away. That's very sobering. It's very sobering to think that. And that's the average age. For some, it's much younger. And yet it is so easy, isn't it, to continue to reside in that position of ownership. This is who I am. This is happening to me. And, you know, intellectually, we don't even agree with that tendency. But the tendency tends to prevail. You know, I am the body. The body is me. And we see in relationship to the body, yes, there is certainly pain within dukkha-dukkha, the pain of pain. But there is so much pain that happens through simply the identification of I am. Of I am. I think the last piece I want to talk about, because you may actually become rather weary of hearing about embodying the body. And, you know, that's not a good sign. We need to be passionate about it. But the last piece I want to talk about embodying the body, is how much really embodying the body really becomes a doorway for understanding the second way of establishing mindfulness, of feeling time, of pleasant, unpleasant, and that which is neither. Those feeling tones that pervade all experience and all sensory impressions. Now, from the perspective of evolutionary science, we are conditioned to have a particular set relationship to the pleasant and to the unpleasant. You know, from the perspective of evolutionary science, we are hardwired to approach the pleasant and endeavor to keep it, and to avoid and flee from the unpleasant. And basically, this is our, it was a survival mechanism. It's sometimes still really useful, you know. It's really good to know how to jump out of the path of a speeding bus, to take our hand away from the fire. You know, it's helpful for us to know and recognize, you know, what actually comforts and cares for the well-being of our body. From the perspective of understanding dukkha, We have a lot of compassion for the ways that we psychologically relate to those feeling tones and how they've gone beyond survival mechanism into self-protection mechanism, protecting clinging. We approach the pleasant with clinging and grasping because it supports the feeling of I am. You know, we certainly do a great deal to avoid the unpleasant and abandon it because it undermines the sense of I am. And when we just don't know whether it's pleasant or unpleasant, we would rather just fall asleep because we don't know who I am in the face of that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Understanding, I think, this, I think it allows, you know, we see this so easily in the body, don't we? That immediate flinch moment, it doesn't really have to be that painful, does it? You know, a little slight sensation in my arm and I'm at it, you know. You know, a little bit of coolness and I've got the blankets on, you know. A little bit of warmth and I'm looking for who to blame, you know. you know, I mean, we actually see it so easily in the body. You know, you have a pleasant sensation. I, you know, love to hang out here for a while. Well, but we can have a little bit more compassion for this because we actually really see that we're swimming against the tide, not only of our distorted, reactive relationship to the pleasant and the unpleasant, but we're swimming also against the tide of our physiological conditioning, you know, our hard wiring. But the Buddha was so clear about us really being deeply interested to this aspect of experience in our body and instructed again and again to really notice what is pleasant, to really be aware of what is unpleasant, to be aware of what is neither, and to see our relationship to them. Because that is the building block of our world of the moment. And, you know, the formula that the Buddha used is very simple. You know, he says that what we contact through our sense doors, we feel, either pleasant or unpleasant, or neither, which we're usually not aware of. What we contact, we feel. What we feel, we perceive. What we perceive, we proliferate about. What we proliferate about, we dwell upon. And what we dwell upon, we become. And he talked about us laying down these pathways of identification, moment to moment, but to see it, it is a process. You know, we don't just end up magically in that place that says, you know, oh, I'm sick, or I hate this, or I feel terrible, or, you know, I'm terrific. We don't just magically end up there. There is a trackable process that we can see and experience, and all that it really requires is some mindfulness and some interest and some investigation. And if we can really be present in those places of Vedana, we do not have to end up in those places of I am. There is a choice here. And it is a choice we cultivate. Okay, so that's a good moment for a pause moment. Is there any questions or reflections? Yeah.
In working with Vedana, it's helpful for me to know unpleasant or pleasant. And I know you don't like the word neutral.
No, I don't.
So what is your note for that which is neither? Are you saying that which is neither?
Okay, so for some of you who are newer, the question was around Vedana. Now, you may not be familiar with this term, and Vedana refers to this kind of very primary sensory impression of something being pleasant or unpleasant. So it's not emotional. It's very simple. You know, I stroke my hand and it's pleasant. Somebody else strokes my hand and it might be unpleasant, especially if it's a stranger. You know? And just pointing out the helpfulness of actually noting, this is pleasant, that's a pleasant sound, that's an unpleasant sound. It's a pleasant sensation, that's an unpleasant sensation. And then there's this middle ground, and the reason I don't like the word neutral is because it's not in the text anywhere. So it's that which is neither pleasant nor unpleasant, and what kind of note do you apply there? Well, mostly we don't notice those moments, is the truth, because they are the quietest moments. In truth, they are said to occupy about 80% of our present moment experience in terms of sensory impression. Yeah. In this moment, probably about 80% of actually the available sensory impressions are neither pleasant nor unpleasant. Anyone excited about, well, actually, this is kind of pleasant. So sometimes you're in situations it's hard to point out that, but, you know, I'm not particularly excited about the color of these sponges. So they would fall, you know, if I look at them, they would fall within that realm of being neither particularly pleasant nor unpleasant. But for me, but mostly then I wouldn't even notice them. You know, my eyes would skid over them and focus much more on what is either pleasant or unpleasant. That's the way we are hardwired. We are hardwired towards vigilance. And, you know, we're hardwired towards vigilance from the perspective of evolutionary science for survival. We're hardwired toward vigilance from the perspective of craving and aversion for gratification. Okay, so I come in the room and I look for what's everything that's pleasant, you know, the person I'd like to sit beside, the best looking cushion, you know, the best looking tea, you know, and I would be on hypervigilant, you know, to stay around, away from the person I have suspicions about, you know, the uncomfortable looking cushion or the place where I might be visible. That which is more neutral, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, I would hardly notice. Okay. So you don't have to worry about it too much because it's not entering into the field of your awareness very much. However, you will notice, just if you were to experiment a little bit, that if you pay attention to that which you usually skip over, it doesn't stay neither pleasant nor unpleasant because the nature of mindfulness itself is pleasant. So the very nature of mindfulness itself actually has some effect on how we actually perceive. So then, you know, so I wouldn't really worry about noting that area too much because it's not really going to sit in your attention too much. Except there are exceptions to that. You know, you can be sitting in meditation and, you know, when there's more calmness and more stillness, you know, a lot of things don't really register as being particularly pleasant or unpleasant. Now, it's a very critical point in meditation because it's sometimes the point where you say, nothing's happening, I'm bored, I'm going to sleep, or actually you pay attention to eventlessness, which initially seems neither pleasant nor unpleasant, and eventlessness becomes really quite a pleasant place to abide. Anything else up? Yes, please.
You were speaking of recollecting the moment, and then it seems like I can recollect. Well, I don't understand that because recollection seems to be looking back at something and the moment is happening now.
But one of the terms, so the question is about recollecting the present moment. It's actually present moment recollection.
Oh.
Okay, so it's a present moment collectedness. And a present moment collectedness is kind of recollecting. You know, think of this regathering, recollecting my intentions, my attention, my mind, my body, regathering them all into one place. You know, I think of it as that sense of regathering is almost a better word. However, it's good to remember that there is a nuance in sati, or mindfulness, which the direct translation is remembering. Remembering to be where we are. Remembering to attend to what is actually going on. And, you know, we actually exercise that quality of remembering quite a lot in meditation. You know, we're kind of lost, gone, and suddenly something, there's a slight glimmer, and we remember to come back, and we remember to reestablish intention or mindfulness of the body. So there is that quality of remembering, which is not so much concerned with what has gone by, but actually remembering much more present moment intention and aspiration, which I think is probably a significant aspect of embodiment. Because, you know, if we think about what remembering is an antidote to, it's forgetting. You know, and many times we just forget, don't we? We forget about being here, you know. We look good, we look like a Buddha, you know, sitting there so calmly. And we are completely elsewhere. So the remembering is an antidote to that forgetfulness which so easily pervades our lives and actually makes understanding very inaccessible. But actually we also, you have to remember, in moments of forgetfulness, we actually really forget a lot. You know, we forget about our aspirations, we forget about our intentions, we forget about what we most deeply value. So when we talk about present moment remembering and present moment recollecting, it's not just about coming back to the breath, or it's not just about coming back to the body. In a sense, it is learning to remember that whole territory of why we're there. You know, what our practice is dedicated to, the intentions and the aspirations. So it's bigger, I think, much bigger than just, oh, you know, I got lost, I come back to the next breath. You know, I think this quality of remembering has many more nuances. Yeah. Yes, please. Correct.
But that it's an opportunity to an antidote or an opportunity to notice or distance oneself from the creation of the eye.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not that it's not important whether they're pleasant or unpleasant, but it's recognizing that that is much out of our control. You know, those conditions of whether it's pleasant or unpleasant is much out of our control. But from the perspective of Buddhist psychology, in terms of the psychology of liberation, when the Buddha places so much importance upon seeing this and seeing this in the body, because that is the place where we can sever the link that feels so automatic between pleasant and craving, unpleasant and fear and aversion, which are actually the beginning of growing the self of the moment. So the more that we can actually bring mindfulness into, instead of reactivity in those moments, we're actually severing that link that seems so automatic. And actually in that moment, we're not constructing the world of self of the moment. And the primary place, as Buddha suggested, the primary place to begin to do this is within the body, including all of the sense doors. And it happens so quickly, doesn't it? You know, there's the sound I don't like, there's my aversion to it, here comes my busyness to try and fix it, here comes my fear of what happens if I can't control this, here I am just thinking about it, ruminating about it, dwelling upon it, it's the shape of my mind, I am. I'm so angry at something, or I'm so irritated by something. It's so quick. But then, of course, the job of mindfulness is to begin to slow that process down, to begin to be so embodied, so inhabiting the body, that we're much closer to the beginnings of that world-building and self-building. And there, the choices kind of stand almost in front of us. of either to walk down that pathway of building or to know that actually there's a freer way of relating to that, which is not indifference, you know, so that's not that they don't matter. It's not indifference, but it's about how do I care for this? What does this need? Drawing on the liberating rather than on the imprisoning. Yeah. The alternative would be, you know, I have that unpleasant sound or I have that unpleasant sensation in the body. I know it. I'm bringing in that element of mindfulness of just knowing it. Ah, this is unpleasant. I'm bringing in this protective element of mindfulness, which is actually knowing that the impulses of aversion may arise, but they don't need feeding with thought and with rumination or obsession. It's knowing I can meet this unpleasant with, I can ask what it needs. It might be kindness, it might be some kind of change, but I can ask that from a place of relatedness, of having a dialogue with the unpleasant, rather than having already abandoned it. So those are the kind of choices that begin to open for us. A lot of it rests upon knowing what's going on and actually being there within the body. Yeah, and all of that is within the domain of skillful means. Okay, so I'd like to move on a little bit for a little bit of time, and then we will have a time for a break. So the second area of embodiment that I feel is really an incredibly crucial area for us to investigate is the embodiment of intentions. And within this word, intentions, I include also attitudes, okay? Now it's sometimes said that the whole of this path rests upon the head of the pin of intention. That intention is karma, or karma, if you're used to that word. Intention is karma. And in a way, the whole of our life rests upon the head of the pin of intention. Now, please don't automatically assume that intention is conscious and wholesome, okay? Intention is the gas in the car. It's what keeps our life moving. It's what keeps our mouth moving. It's what keeps our actions moving. And it's what keeps our mind moving. Okay? It is the fuel of movement. Now, intention, of course, moves. Skillful, compassionate, wise action, speech, and choice. And in many ways, our life exemplifies our intentions of the moment. In a way, your body right now is exemplifying your intention of the moment. Okay, this is not abstract. Intention also moves anger, fear, greed, self-protectiveness. But when intention arises, so too does action. When intention arises, so too does movement, be it in the body, in the speech, or in our mind. Intention moves into embodiment. So a path of awareness actually asks us to be mindful of what is moving all of this. What is moving all of this action, whether it is physical or verbal or psychological or cognitive, to learn to have the sensitivity and to be aware and to bring intention into the field of consciousness. To bring intention into the field of mindfulness. Now, when intention is not in the field of consciousness, or not in the field of mindfulness, Generally, the way that it is experienced is in the form of impulse and reactivity. Is that clear? Okay. So when intention is not in the field of consciousness and mindfulness, it generally takes the form of impulse and reactivity, which certainly generates lots of movement, doesn't it? Lots of movement of thought, lots of movement of body, and sometimes lots of movement of speech. There is a saying from a Roman philosopher that we can go through life like puppets, dancing on the ends of the strings of our impulses. It's not a particularly heartening picture, is it? Sadly, it can be quite true, which is that, have you noticed that? You know how it's possible just to move from one impulsive moment to the next. Now, without mindfulness, this critical dimension of our experience that shapes the kind of world that we live in, moment to moment, becomes shrouded in a kind of confusion. And these are the moments when we ask of ourselves, how did I end up here? And this is usually followed by the word again. How did I end up here again? You know, how did I possibly manage to fall into that same pattern again? How did I possibly manage to react in exactly the same way again, even though I've done it 100 times, and on some level I know better? But there it is again. Finding ourselves in a place that we would rather not be, irritated, napping, impatient, angry, reacting. I have this wonderful sort of image in my mind of, you have IKEA here? A lot of you have been. You know what it's like to have an IKEA experience? You know, they were psychologists. I mean, I know IKEA does a wonderful service to the world, in case any of you are stakeholders, shareholders, but I mean, really. Have you ever got lost in IKEA? And it's designed that you can't find your way out. You know? And when you're the 50th time in a kitchens and say, I don't know how I got here, and you can't find the exit, and they tell you, oh, you only need to keep your eye on the lion on the floor, but then everything's designed so that you don't keep your eye on the lion on the floor. So you keep losing the lion on the floor, and you're back in kitchens again. You ever spent any time hanging out at the checkouts at IKEA? You know, people go in looking so enthusiastic. Come out at the end and they're haggard. You know, it's kind of like their faces have collapsed, you know. But you get a hot dog at the end, you know. You know, just to restore your faith at IKEA and let you come back. But I think, you know, I think it's such a classic example of psychological process. You know, I'm there again. You know, I'm there in that rumination again. I'm there in that obsession again. You know, I can't believe it. And here I am again. And I have learned 1,000 times, you know, that this is not helpful. And I'm there again. So what's the job of mindfulness? Find the exit sign. Find the exit sign. Whenever you see one of those circularity loops beginning to arise, keep your eye on your exit sign. You know, and this really is the job of mindfulness. And this actually, you know, saves the health and well-being of our mind. But the Buddha talks so much about, you know, the circularity of experience. In fact, this is the translation of some samsara. I have a Pali colleague who criticizes me every time I say samsara. It's not samsara. Apparently it's sangsara, okay? Just so that you don't get into trouble in your future Pali escapades. But sangsara actually translates as going in circles. Going in circles, traveling in circles. And the Buddha speaks a lot about the circularity of experience, about going in circles. And then, of course, what the path is meant to be is to find the way out of that repetition. Finding your exit sign. And the exit sign certainly begins with mindfulness, to begin to dispel the fog, the sense of being lost. And the path of embodiment is to align our intentions and all that follows from them, our speech, our actions, and our choices, with our deepest intentions and values. And this is the challenge of I think, embodiment. How to come to that alignment. Because we know when there is discrepancy, and we know when there's non-alignment or disharmony or dissonance. And this is acutely painful to someone on this path. And it's not a negative pain. It's a pain that, well, it can be greeted with a lot of shame. But it's actually the path, the pain that teaches us to wake up. So if we think about intention, it's very clear that intention looks in two directions. Okay? So intention, first of all, looks backwards to our moods, to our emotions, to our clarity or confusion of the moment. Intention looks backwards to the ground of mindfulness or the ground of forgetfulness. And then intention looks forwards to our actions, our speech, and our thoughts. So intention is this linking quality. It's a linking mechanism that begins to shape our world of the moment. So our intentions will determine actually what is being brought into our world of the moment, both inwardly and outwardly. And there's that question, are we aware of the intentions in this moment that are shaping our body? Sleepiness, wakefulness, interest, disinterest. Are we aware of the intentions of this moment that are shaping our thoughts of this moment? Preoccupations, obsessions, confusion, clarity, curiosity. When we go to lunch or go home, are we aware of the intentions that are shaping our speech and actions? How we use our sense doors, whether we slump in front of the TV, how we speak to our partner, how we sit in the traffic jam. This is a contemplation of the moment, because we don't just have one intention in a day. We can see the winds of intentionality both consciously set or unconsciously governing throughout the entirety of our day. And I think, you know, part of mindfulness, part of remembering, is actually knowing that we actually don't set conscious intention just once, but possibly 100 or 1,000 times in every day. Is that quite clear for you? Do you have any questions about that? Yes, please. Am I using the word intention the same as volition? Now, one thing that is really good to notice is that it doesn't take much effort to have unconscious intentionality. It doesn't require any effort, does it? You know, it doesn't take me much effort to kind of snap at people or, sloth around or fall asleep. It doesn't take much effort for me to do that. So it's interesting that the unskillful and the unhelpful really doesn't require, generally speaking, much effort. But the skillful, intention. So impulse requires very little effort, does it? Reactivity doesn't require much effort. I'm going to really try to be angry here, you know. It just doesn't require the effort, does it? But you do notice that the wholesome intentions, the conscious intentions, actually do require effort. They require often great effort, I would say. But because skillful and wholesome intentions are joy and happiness producing, that what takes actually so much effort initially to kind of change the shape of the mind becomes with practice much less effortful. But it is so important to acknowledge that impulse requires is one of the most effortless domains of our life, where skillful intention actually requires the commitment of effort. Okay, so I think, yes, I'm sorry.
I've got a question about effort versus willpower.
Yeah.
They're not the same, are they?
No.
Because, okay, so it's like a skillful effort.
Willpower. Willpower is a self mechanism. Oh, so it is. Willpower, striving are self mechanisms. They are about getting, about producing, about becoming. Effort, wise effort, certainly the way the Buddhists talk about it, is a way of emptying the moment of self. Very distinctly different. They're definitely a way of emptying the moment of self. Because certainly from the perspective of the teaching, you know, emptying of the moment of self does not come about through some willful command to let go. But emptying the moment of self is born of actually cultivating the skillful efforts that provide the conditions inwardly for letting go to happen all by itself.